Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. Excuse me, we're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today is Wednesday, April 16th, 2014. And before we go on, I should say that the opinions and views that you hear on the program this morning are those of my guests and me, and not the university regents or anybody connected with the university, something like that. Anyway, today my guests are mystery writers Jill Amadio and Sheila Lowe. And first up is Jill Amadio. She's an award-winning journalist, author, collaborator, ghostwriter, and screenwriter. She was a newspaper reporter in England, Spain, and Thailand. In the U.S., she worked for Gannett newspapers, Condé Nast, and several other publications. One of her essays appeared in the Faber and Faber book, Ladies, Start Your Engines. And I have to say, because I know Jill, that she also had a speaking part in Dr. Zhivago when she was a mere tot. So if you if you watch the movie, look for her on the steps, and she you'll see her right there. And she's here to talk about her first novel, primarily written under her own name, Digging Too Deep, a Tosca Trevant mystery. Hi, Jill.
Hello, Barbara.
And I have her in the studio with me, and it's nice to have you here.
Well, I've known you a long time, and I listen to your program all the time.
Well, I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
So Tosca is a Brit, and she comes to the U.S. to visit her daughter, and because she's in trouble in the U.K., she gets kicked out of the U.K., or at least she has to leave.
She's actually banished to the colonies.
She's banished to the colonies.
She discovered a royal scandal.
Okay.
And so her daughter lives here already. She's a race car driver and lives on in Newport Beach, sunny Southern California. And she comes to live with her daughter, not very reluctantly, actually.
But she has, she's digging around, though. She can't stay out of trouble.
Well, the thing is, she's supposed to be trying to find some local gossip, but she's used to covering the royals, and she can't find a duchess or a prince anywhere in America.
That could be a problem.
And she's very curious and nosy. So, yes, she goes digging around. She's, you know, Brits love their flowers, their gardens. And one of her next door neighbors, the garden is full of weeds. So she decides she's going to go in there and help that poor man out. He's a recent widower. His wife just died. And so she goes into the garden to weed and discovers things she'd never seen before.
Yes, she does. Okay, let's back up just a little. Why a fictional setting? Why not Balboa? I mean, for those of you who are from Orange County, who live here, you'll recognize where it takes place. But it's a fictional setting, fictional Orange County setting. Why did you do that?
Well, I lived on Balboa Island for 12 years and loved it. And it has a ferry there. I had to move the ferry for the plot.
Yes.
And I had to move a couple of streets over. So that's why I gave it a different name.
Interesting. Has anybody commented on that, maybe live on Balboa?
No, but they all recognize Balboa Island.
Well, that reminds me of, I think, Joseph Wamba's The Golden Orange. Didn't he fictionalize area, too, because of what he was writing?
Yes, his book was set during Christmas on Balboa Island, mm-hmm. and he had the ferry join the Christmas parade of boats.
Right.
The ferry driver just says, the heck with this.
Right.
And he joined the parade. It was the funniest thing I've ever read.
So I'm also, you know, I have all these questions. Hopefully I'll be able to get most of them in, but I was also curious, and I remember, I think I told you, I remember your story from when we were in Fictionaires many years ago.
Yeah, and, writing group.
Yeah, writing group. Mm-hmm. And why a cozy rather than another genre or subgenre in the mystery area?
Well, I rather like gentle murders. I'm not into gore or violence, but I love puzzles and clues and cat and mouse games. And so mine is basically a traditional mm-hmm. mystery. And
has rules.
Yes, it has rules. So, and that's what I love the most to read.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what are the rules? What are the rules of a cozy?
Well, you can't have cruelty to animals. Mm-hmm. Well, I actually have a little teeny bit. But it's a squirrel, so it's not a pet.
Okay.
And you can't have lots of blood and violence. No sex, maybe a kiss. And that's about it. And usually they're set in small village-type places, mm-hmm. which my little island is
Isabella's.
In Newport Beach. Yes. It's like a village. And it reminds Tosca of her where she grew up in her village, a fishing village in Cornwall.
Okay.
St. Ives, yeah.
And she is a gossip columnist in the UK.
Yeah, she covers the royal family.
Okay. And in the book, you use the device of excerpting her column at the beginning of some of the chapters.
Yes, I do. Well, after she was banished to the colonies, not too shabby to be banished to Newport Beach, she was asked to send a gossip column back every week. So I start each chapter with an excerpt from her column, which is called Tiara Tittle Tattle. Well, now it's called something in America, but it's the one in England was called Tiara Tittle Tattle because of the royal family.
I'd love to hear you read. And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Jill Amadio, and she's about to read from Digging Too Deep, a Tosca Trevant mystery.
Okay, I'm going to read an excerpt from her column that she sends to England every day. And she calls it Letter from a Lonely Outpost. And it starts, "Hello, dear reader. I have settled onto this lovely little island and will be ferreting out some delicious tidbits for you from this side of the big pond. I miss the Savoy and the Ritz Bar terribly, but have just discovered there's a Ritz right here, thank heavens, even though it is in the middle of a shopping mall where fashionistas are buying a new perfume called Gossip, an omen perhaps. Someone here has written a 147-page poem. Took him 40 years, and he says he doesn't completely understand it. Not surprising. Toodaloo, sweet reader, till next time." I should mention that the neighbor's wife has just died.
Okay.
So then this chapter begins. Tosca thought about the neighbor's wife as she left JJ's apartment for her usual early morning walk. She found it difficult to recognize the darkness of death when every day now was filled with sunshine. After a week on Isabel Island, Tosca was in love with the balmy Southern California climate, but still missed the frequent cloudbursts that freshened her English homeland. As she strode briskly around the 3-mile seafront, a folded parasol at the ready in her hand, she examined everything in sight with a suspicious eye. She'd given up counting the dozens of powerboats docked in the bay, the small boats bobbing on moorings, and the expensive yachts berthed alongside private docks, matching the opulence of the chic beach homes crammed together like dominoes in a box. Snow-clad mountains towered in the distance, dwarfing the gleaming white skyscrapers of Newport Beach's luxury hotels and office buildings. But every day brought a new dilemma. "What? No proper tea shop nearby," she protested to JJ, her daughter. Tosca glanced skyward as she walked. "And Barth and Jowl." These are Cornish cuss words, by the way. "Not a drop of rain either." As the sun lazily nudged itself over the hills and took its first look of the day at the wide Newport Beach harbor and the bay big enough to embrace 7 small islands, Tosca opened the parasol to shade herself. She called out a cheerful good morning to a jogger as he passed. Foremost in her mind, though, was where to find the kind of gossip for her column from America that her editor demanded while she sought a crime to solve. "Stuart," she said, "I don't think there's much royal gossip where I'm going, and certainly no authentic royalty. Can't I be an investigative reporter instead?" she'd asked for the fourth time before she left London. Not that Tiara felt that the Tiara Tittle-Tattle column was beneath her, especially since she inevitably managed to ferret out private tidbits before anyone realized they'd revealed them. For 11 years, she'd held her readers enthralled or appalled, depending on their sympathies toward the throne. That is, until she was rather swiftly banished, she complained, just like the exiled Duke of Windsor, who was booted to the Bahamas for marrying an American divorcee. Exalted company indeed, but humiliating. She was grateful that the London Daily Post readers knew nothing of the real reason for her reassignment. Tosca's farewell column was headlined, "Goodbye, London. Hello, Los Angeles." And the new title was Tête-à-Tête with America. When the editor called her into his office to tell her, she said, "Oh, for goodness sake, Stuart, that sounds fatuous. And what am I supposed to be writing out about? How America takes tea? The tea partiers? Tête-à-tête, indeed. I think my reassignment is a perfect opportunity for a splendid new start as an investigative reporter. How about it?"
Thank you so much. That was Jill Amadio reading from Digging Too Deep. So regarding these Cornish curse words, I'm guessing that the cozy genre also doesn't permit swearing.
No, it doesn't. But these are very nice ones. I actually talked to a professor in Cornwall who teaches the Cornish language. And he sent me a list of very, very nice cuss words.
And are you from Cornwall?
I am.
Okay.
Yes.
So that, because it has a certain authenticity that I don't think you could get through Google or, you know, picking up a Google map and walking through.
No, no. We lived in St. Ives, which is a fishing village and an art colony. It has the only branch of the Tate Gallery there.
Oh, huh.
And Tosca takes a bit of dig at the Tate Gallery architecture in her book. But it's a beautiful place. It has more sun than anywhere else in England, which isn't saying much.
Okay, I'm always curious why authors choose particular ages for their characters. And Tosca is, I think, almost 50.
Yes.
So why that age?
I think because she has maturity, experience. Her daughter is 27, I believe. And you can tell by her dialogue, she has a lot to learn. But she is very prim and proper, which is the opposite to her mother, who's a bit eccentric. But no, I think older men and women can share. Like, I'm sharing a lot of my own experiences in my writing. And by 50, you've probably accumulated quite a bit.
And also, she's, excuse me, quite an extrovert. And because you seem rather introverted. I mean, I think most writers are more on the introverted
side. Yeah, I'm
quiet. Yeah, so is she like a part of you that... that if you were an extrovert, that's who you would be?
She probably says things I would never dare to.
But would like to.
She doesn't have much of a filter. But she's also very direct, because she finds if you're direct with people and say what you think within reason, it saves a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. Early on in Digging Too Deep, you write about, or I don't know if it's from her point of view, it's from someone's point, it must be from her point of view, something about the way a character smiled gave her pause, because there are 18 different kinds of smiles. And I found that really interesting, and I love it when novels give me something that I don't know. And so I stopped and I was thinking, I have to research this, like all the different smiles that tell you different things.
Yes, I did tons of research. There are 18 different smiles, and they all mean something different. And I also researched geology, because I send her to Anza Borrego, to the desert, mm-hmm. where there are concretions, which are round stones, small boulders, mm-hmm. that grow around a fossil or something. And I also have her going to coming here to UCI to research Arnold Schoenberg's music, classical music. Mm. So I researched a lot of music, a lot of opera, archaeology even, and of course forensics, yes. And she goes to Mexico too. So I had to research some funeral homes in Mexico.
So where does the research end and the writing begin, or are you doing it throughout depending on what you're writing, depending on what scene you're at or what section of the book?
Yeah, I'm what writers call a pantser. Mm-hmm. That means you write by the seat of your pants rather than plot everything out, get all the outlines written, do all the research first. I just sit down and write, and sometimes stuff appears on my monitor screen. And I'll be typing away, and like for the smiles, I had a smile, and then I thought, I wonder how many smiles there are, different ones. So that's when I start mm-hmm. to do the research, when I get to
when
that place
it.
In the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I'm just, stuff shows up sometimes when you're typing. I'll look at something I've typed and say, oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. And it sort of just comes out of your subconscious.
Right. Well, I like that because it also, I'm a pantser too then, and I think it's more fun in a way to see where you end up, and you know, you're on page 100, now what? Well, maybe it could go like this because of all this that has happened.
Exactly. It's fascinating because characters show themselves up mm-hmm. even, and I think, oh, gosh, who's this person? And then I'll do, you know, give them some character. Some traits and everything else. And I was just at the LA Festival of Books signing my book, and hundreds of people go by the booth. And I found a wonderful woman there who was kind of strolling along, and she was perfect for my book. So she'll be one of the characters. I mean, what she was wearing and her posture, all that stuff. So I made a few notes, and I'll put her in the book.
So obviously, when we see the subtitle, A Tosca Trevant Mystery, that tells us that there's another one coming.
Yes, I've already started writing the second book.
So you knew from the start it would be a series.
Yes.
But you didn't know what the second book would be?
Well, I created what people have said is a very strong character. Mm-hmm. And for me, the character drives the plot. And if there wouldn't be a plot in my
right.
book without Tosca's character. Mm-hmm. So I love that. I love doing it that way. Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. Are series more popular in the mystery genre?
Yes, because once somebody can relate to a character or falls in love with a character, they want to read more mm-hmm. about that character.
Mm-hmm.
I just had somebody write a wonderful review for me on Goodreads, which is a online, and he said, a delightful romp that gives readers a new reason to fall in love with the cozy mystery genre all over again. I can't wait to see what's next for Tosca Trevant on our side of the pond.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really nice.
That's nice.
Actually, I'm going to keep her here for two or three books, and then I'm going to send her back to England because the royal family was thinking of suing her. So she's got to go back and face the music.
They need money.
Yeah,
they need
right.
to pay the rent. I mean,
yes,
you know.
Exactly.
We have a few minutes left with Jill Amadio. Her book is Digging Too Deep. Actually, she's going to be with us with the second author that's coming on because they're friends, and so she's going to help me out here. But you know, I remember you, you've written a lot of books. You ghostwrite as
yes,
well.
Yes, I've written 12, 13, I think.
And I remember a story about a novel that you ghostwrote for somebody. And you wrote an essay then for the LA Times Magazine when it was still a true magazine,
oh, yeah.
edited by Marty Smith. And it was an essay about attending a book signing that for a book that you ghostwrote, but the woman that you ghostwrote it for was sitting at the table signing the books.
Yes, it was a crime novel, actually. She'd always wanted her name on a book. She was very wealthy, lived in Beverly Hills, and delightful. And she hired me to ghostwrite this crime novel, which was wonderful because I thought, oh, I'll get to practice for my own mystery. And so she said, well, you've got to come to the book signing. I've invited hundreds of my friends. So I said, no, it's your deal. You go. No, you must come. So I went. I know where to stand. She's sitting at the table with my book piled up on it, signing her name on my book. And so I thought, I'll stand behind her. I'm the ghost. And so she said, no, stand over next to me. And she kept introducing me as her writer. Like you'd say, this is my maid, here's my butler, this is my gardener, here's the writer. And it was the funniest thing I'd ever experienced.
Was it her idea, or did she just want a book and you came up with a plot?
She wanted a novel, actually, and about a financial problem, a situation that she herself had been involved in. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, let's spice it up with a couple of murders. And then she kept going to Paris or Rome. And she kept saying, well, just keep writing. And we don't really have a plot. Oh, do whatever you like. And it was wonderful because I did.
So then writing your own, this is your first novel.
It is.
So what changed? I mean, it must be just like a far cry from ghostwriting a novel for someone else.
It is. You know, I mean, I write all these biographies. I've done some very interesting ones. One was for a U.S. ambassador who just died at 93. And he was on the USS Missouri when the Japanese came on board to surrender. And he had marvelous stories. But after a while, you want your own talent in there. Mm-hmm. You want your own book and not somebody else's name on your book.
Yeah. I can't believe we're at the end of our time, but you're going to be with us still throughout the next.
Oh, how nice. My friend Sheila.
But before we go.
She's a Brit, too.
She's a Brit, too.
Yes.
But not with a very strong accent.
Well, she came here when she was 12, I believe.
And you came?
Oh, gosh. With three children.
Uh-huh. So any last words or advice for the writers listening, especially perhaps writers working on a mystery?
Well, read a lot of mysteries and read the ones that you want to write. You know, if you want to write a noir, read noir books. If you want to read traditional, read the classical, like P.D. James and Agatha Christie. If you're writing thrillers, read those kinds of books. Suspense, read suspense books. So that you get an idea of the genre. Mm-hmm. It's very important because readers look for specific genres. And certainly a noir reader would never read my book, mm-hmm. probably. Mm-hmm. So you have to know your market. You have to know who's writing what these days. But don't follow trends because by the time your book comes out, mm-hmm. or unless you go to some of the self-publishing, you know, the trend could be over by the time your book is out.
Right.
So it's quite a business. The mm-hmm. business of writing business. Side is so time-consuming, and all that social media networking you have to do.
Yeah.
I just want to sit and write.
Yeah, don't we all? Thank you. And again, you're not going anywhere. You're going to be right here.
No.
So
lovely.
You've been listening to Writers on Writing. This was Jill Amadio and Digging Too Deep, a Tosca Trevant mystery. And it's published by Mainly Murder Press. We're going to take a real short break. And when we come back, we'll have Sheila with us and Jill. So don't go anywhere.
Was that all right?
Thank you.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. And I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I was here, and I still am, with Jill Amadio during the first half, and we are back. Jill is with me, and now we have Sheila Rowe on the line. Like her fictional character, Claudia Rose, in the award-winning Forensic Handwriting Mysteries mystery series, Sheila Lowe is a real-life forensic handwriting expert who testifies in handwriting-related cases. She holds a Master's of Science in Psychology and is licensed to provide continuing education for marriage and family therapists. As well as her mysteries, she has a couple of books, nonfiction books, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Handwriting Analysis and Handwriting of the Famous and Infamous. Her analyses of celebrity handwritings have appeared in Time, Teen People, Tiger Beat, Mademoiselle, and numerous Bar Association magazines. And she's about to be featured in the May issue of Real People, the UK equivalent to People magazine. Hi, Sheila.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello, Sheila.
Hi, Jill. I was listening to you, and I think you've said it all. And well.
No.
Let's begin by, Jill and I were talking before the show, Sheila, and I asked her if she knew how you came to be a handwriting analyst, and she couldn't tell me. So she's interested, too. How did that come about?
Oh, I just spoke on that at an author luncheon the other day. We have to go back in time to 1967, if you can remember that far back. I was in high school, going to Anaheim High School, and my boyfriend's mother had read a book on handwriting. And she analyzed my handwriting, and when I read the things that she wrote about me, I was fascinated, because here she was saying, you know, you're emotionally stormy, and you're, you know, this and that, and of course, at the time, I didn't realize that you could describe any 17-year-old girl as emotionally stormy, but it was true, and all the other things, too. So I started reading everything I could get my hands on and went to the Anaheim Library and bought books. And I studied for about 10 years on my own before I started taking courses and became certified as a graphologist and then eventually court-qualified as a handwriting expert.
And then how did your mystery series come out of that?
Well, I've always loved mystery ever since I was 8 years old and got a book by Enid Blyton, and Jill will know who that
is.
I
remember her.
Yes, for my birthday I got, I think it was The Sea of Adventure, and it was my first mystery, and I just loved mystery. And when I started writing, which was when I was about 13, I started writing stories about the Beatles. Because I was 14, actually, when I came to this country, and the Beatles followed me over, is the way I'd like to think about it.
But, of course they
did. So I was writing stories about the Beatles, but I always wanted to write a mystery. But it wasn't until much, much later in life that I did.
And then there was Claudia Rose.
Yeah, because by then I had my handwriting analysis practice, and so I had lots of stories to call on. And they say write what you know, and that's what I did. I thought, well,
there's the experience coming in again. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's using your own experiences.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so yeah. That's what I did.
So then talk about, because you have four, I think you have four mysteries and a fifth one coming in June.
Actually, I have five. The current book is a standalone, but my series characters are in it in a more secondary role. And I heard that you had Jill read from her book, and if you have me read from any of mine, I'd like it to be the standalone, because
let's do it.
I do have a new series book coming out June 10th.
Let's hear you read. I'd love that.
Oh,
and give us
okay.
the title, too.
It's What She Saw, and it's a book about a young woman who wakes up on a train not knowing who she is or where she's going.
Okay.
So I have a couple of bits from chapter one.
Okay.
The first thing she noticed was the sound, metal wheels rolling on rails, thumming in time with her heartbeat. Instinct whispered that if she could only screw up the courage to pry open her eyes, she would see the world hurtling past with the breathless rush of a roller coaster. But that kind of courage had deserted her. How long had she been sitting upright, hands clasped in her lap, knees and ankles pressed together as tightly as if they were bound? Hours? Days? Despite the gradual unraveling thread by delicate thread of the heavy curtain that separated consciousness from the abyss, the answer was proving elusive. Her mouth tasted as toxic as the dregs at the bottom of a mezcal bottle. Had she had too much to drink? Was that why her head was so fuzzy? She could not remember. The chill of refrigerated air stippled her flesh with goosebumps, a reliable indicator that at least her sensory perceptions were in working order. Rubbing her arms, she continued the inventory. Sense of touch? Check. The ropey odor of a pot smoker nearby? Olfactory? Check. Valley girl chatter somewhere behind her? Hearing? Check. But there, the inventory came to an abrupt halt. To acknowledge her sense of sight would mean coming to grips with the grotesque truth that hammered at her brain, a truth too terrifying to name. And then we skip to the end of the first chapter where she's gotten off the train. The Ventura Amtrak station was a mere strip of concrete, maybe 50 yards long, a couple of benches, an electronic ticket machine. She hurried to the end of the wrought iron fence that separated the tracks from the street. You're late. She swung to face the man who had spoken the accusation, her heart pounding like a runaway horse, not sure whether to be relieved when she saw that he was addressing the valley girl who stood there with her hands on her hips, earbuds still plugged in. Oh, like I was driving the train or something, valley girl said rudely. The pair hurried off, still grousing at each other. As she watched them climb into a Mercedes parked at the curb, the train's engine began to rev. At the same moment, a sudden sharp breeze sprang up from the ocean, nipping at her bare arms, reminding her too late that she had no jacket to cover her thin T-shirt. No purse either, she realized in a panic. Jamming her fists into the pockets of her Levi's, first the front, then the back, she clawed at the denim in desperation, but her pockets were empty, not so much as a dime hidden in the seams. No ID either. Mm-hmm. Whirling around, she dashed back onto the platform, but the behemoth was already on the move. Hey, she yelled, running alongside the train, beating her fist uselessly on the siding, heedless of the massive steel wheels turning mere inches from her feet. Hey, wait, wait. And okay. At the end of the chapter, she, moving on autopilot, she walked. The thing that had been clamoring at her since the first inkling of consciousness hit her full bore. The truth she had been warding off, a truth that refused to be silenced. A truth from which she could no longer protect herself. The overwhelming question, to which she had no answer, emerged with the force of a body blow. Who am I?
Thank you. Sheila, give us the title again.
What She Saw.
What She Saw. As you're reading, I started wondering about the difference between writing a standalone and writing a series. Mm-hmm. What's the difference for you, and which is more enjoyable?
Well, they both have their own pluses and minuses, I suppose. For me, the reason why I wrote a standalone was because my series has been published by Penguin, and when my editor, who loved the series, left and a new editor came in and wasn't interested in continuing it, my agent at the time said, well, it's really hard to sell a series in the middle. So I thought, well, then I'll write a standalone to see if I can sell that and then come back to the series. So that was my motivation. But it was a little bit freeing because I was creating new characters. But at the same time, I brought my familiar characters in so that people who loved Claudia Rose would, you know, still have that aspect. They would still have the characters that they knew. So it does give you some freedom, and also writing from a different point of view. It was kind of interesting to see the world through this young woman's eyes.
Mm-hmm. You know, I first learned of you when I attended a Sisters in Crime meeting down here in Orange County, I think back in March. Uh-huh. And you spoke about handwriting analysis, which I found fascinating. And I wanted to know how it works and why it works. I'm so glad I have your book now. But, you know, where did it come from in terms of, you know, working and you know, experts believing that there was something to it?
And is there, and can you predict from handwriting?
Can you predict?
Predict? Well, it's not like psychic. It's not like astrology. It is a science.
Darn.
It would be so much easier if I were psychic. But handwriting is a projective behavior. You know, it's like body language or the tone of your voice or your facial expression. It tells a lot about you. You know, if you see somebody walking across the street, you can tell so much about them. You can see if somebody's depressed or if they're happy and upbeat just by the way they walk. Or, you know, if you see your friend, you know immediately if they're upset or if they're, you know, excited or happy. So handwriting expresses a lot of human behavior. We're not looking, well, there's actually two methods of handwriting analysis. One looks at the individual pieces. It's empirical. It looks at the individual strokes and builds up a picture of personality from that. The method that I use is called Gestalt, and it looks at handwriting as a whole. It's like looking at it through a telescope. You see the whole picture. So it's a question of the spatial arrangement, how the writing is arranged on the page, the space that's left between the letters, the words, the lines, the margins. Then there's the movement of the writing, which includes things like rhythm and pressure and speed and a lot of complex things. And finally, there's the form, which is the style that the writer chooses. Is it copybook, the way they learned in school, or is it simplified, or is it elaborate, or is it printed? And in those things, there are thousands of variables.
Have you analyzed a murderer's handwriting?
Oh, many. I wrote a paper on serial killers.
Ooh. Talk a little bit about that, because you covered a tiny bit of that in the Sisters in Crime talk, which was fascinating.
I think, yeah, well, one of the people ask me, what's the most interesting case you've ever had? And I have to say that it was the handwriting of the man who killed my daughter. And he was her boyfriend, a federal agent, and when I saw his handwriting, because she brought it to me and with his knowledge, and we talked about it, and it showed me some real red flags. Now, no handwriting is going to be able to say this person is going to be a killer. So no, it's not predictive like that. It may be predictive on past behavior as a predictor of possible potential behavior. But it's, you know, it's not like looking at a crystal ball. But there are certainly many red flags that might pop out. So,
such as?
I can generalize, but remember, it depends on the context. You
yes.
have to, what says one thing in one handwriting might have a different interpretation with other elements around it. But in this case, it was an extremely tall, what I would call the upper zone, which are the upper loops. They were disproportionately tall. And I've seen that in the handwritings of authoritarian people. People who, you know, they've got to make the rules, but it's do as I say, not as I do. And they have, you know, very strict expectations. But that in combination, in his case, was with extremely light pressure. Now, extremely light and extremely heavy pressure both come from the same frustration and anger, but they're expressed differently. So the person who has extremely heavy pressure, I mean, to the point of looking like Braille on the back of the paper, that kind of person is likely to act out quickly and have a short fuse. And their anger, you know, you can see it very easily. But a person with extremely light pressure, so light that it's barely on the paper, their frustration and anger keeps building up inside, and you don't see it until it's like a pressure cooker. When it gets to the top, it suddenly bursts out, and in this case, very violently. So wow. There's a whole chapter in my Idiot's Guide on red flags.
What about when you autograph your books, your mysteries? Are you very careful how you sign them?
That's right. Especially in the Idiot's Guide, because then they can look it up.
You use a stamp, right?
Yeah. Well, I find it really hard to autograph, especially the small books, you know, the paperbacks, because your hand is in an awkward position. So I tend to think about that when I'm signing.
You know, I found it interesting, too, during your talk, when you were talking about the handwriting of brain-injured people.
Yes.
And how there's, like, you have found this little dent.
Right, and that was true in the case of Tom Schnabel, the man who killed my daughter. There was a little dent at the top of his upper loops, and I asked him if he had had a blow to the head, and he said he had been hit in the head so hard that he was almost blinded, and he was receiving treatment for severe headaches. So yes, there are certain artifacts of physiological conditions in the handwriting, and that was one of them. If you see little extra dots along the ink line that cannot be explained just by the pen, if they're there consistently, you can see all kinds. I mean, I can't diagnose. I'm not a doctor, but I can say in what areas of the body there are issues.
Wow. That is so interesting.
Amazing. Yes.
We have a few minutes left with Sheila Lowe. Excuse me. She has a few nonfiction books, including The Complete Idiot's Guide to Handwriting Analysis, second edition. And she also has the Claudia Rose Forensic Handwriting Mystery Series and her standalone. So just getting back to writing, writing mysteries, I'm curious, Jill and I talked about this in the first half, but are you more a plot-driven writer or a character-driven writer?
I'm more character-driven. I think because of my interest in psychology, and as a handwriting analyst, that is a branch of psychology, so understanding people. My stories are about ordinary people that are put into extraordinary circumstances. They're not, you know, huge thrillers with lots of blow 'em up, shoot 'em up.
And how much do you know? How much did you know before you started your standalone, and how much do you need to know when you're writing your series?
Well, unlike Jill, I am an outliner, because on my third book, Dead Right, I just started writing, and I got to about five chapters, and I realized I had no idea where I was going. Mm-hmm. So then I stopped and did an outline. But having said that, an outline in that I'll do a little chapter summary of each chapter that I'm planning. But that is subject to change. And in that book, I got to the middle of the book, and I realized that what I had planned for the ending needed to come right there. So I made adjustments.
And along the way, do you, I'm always interested if writers revise along the way or just barrel through that first draft and get to the end and then start over?
No. No, I revise as I go, and I get it just as good as I feel like I possibly can right then before I go on to the next. So when I'm writing, I'll go back and reread what I wrote the day before and edit it and then write the new stuff.
I do sort of the same thing. I try to barrel through, but I start the next day's writing by reading the previous chapter, and that gets me into the scene again, and I continue on from there, but I can't resist doing a little editing of that previous chapter.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I don't like to keep going back and doing drafts, even though I end up doing that, but I just want to make it as good as I can before I go forward.
Do you have readers for your work as you go along, Sheila?
Yes, I have two critique groups, and one of them has been around for more than 10 years, And we don't meet regularly anymore, but we send each other stuff. And then I have another, well, it's not a group anymore. We seem to be losing people. We're scaring them away. But another writer friend and I meet and critique each other's work.
And then how do you deal with the feedback? Do you look for consensus, or do you just kind of feel in your belly what resonates? What do you do with it?
Yeah, well, I listen objectively, and if I agree, then I'll make changes. But if it's something that I'm not sure I agree on, I will ask other friends to look at it.
Yeah, I do the
same.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, no. I do the same thing. I don't have critique groups, per se, but I have four or five specific friends who have been editors and whom I trust. And two of them are poets, actually. And they have a different perspective, which I enjoy.
Well, you said the key word there. And I do always hire an independent editor. Even when I was published with Penguin and they had their own editor who, as it happens, left. I mean, you know, I said she left. Well, she's now an independent editor. And so I have retained her to read my stuff and critique it. So I do have the professional editing.
At what point do you bring her in? Is it when you feel you have a real solid draft, or at what point?
No, because I do have an outline first, so I will go through maybe a third of the book and send it to her, and then send it in chunks. And in fact, this time I used two different editors that I have used in the past. And besides that, because the new book, Inkslinger's Ball, is a lot of it is for the first time from the point of view of my detective character, Joel Jovanich. I did a lot of talking to police detectives in the area, Derek Pacifico, who's a crime writer, what is it called, the homicide school for writers I attended, and then he does consulting work. So I talked a lot to him and to some other detectives.
Interesting.
Yeah, the experts can give you so much information.
Yeah.
And it has to be correct.
Right.
It has to be accurate. Forensics, yeah.
We are sadly at the end of our time, but before we go, Sheila, I wonder if there's any advice that you've received along the way that stuck with you and has been helpful in particular with your writing.
For writing, it seems like a very simple thing, but it made a huge difference, and that is leave out the adverbs whenever possible. I kept getting, when I was trying to sell Poison Pen, which had won in a contest, a good contest, I kept hearing, yeah, the story is good, but it's just not strong enough. And I didn't know what that meant until I went to a real editor, and she pointed out all of those adverbs. And also the other thing was, she said, your character is always feeling guilty. People, your readers don't want your character to be weak. I mean, she can have an arc, but they don't want the character to be weak. So
flaws are okay, though.
Flaws are good.
Yeah, flaws are fine. But, you know, if you don't want to just keep going around feeling guilty or whatever.
Mm.
So that was very helpful to me.
Thank you so much for being with us. One last thing, your website, SheilaLowe.com?
Yes, and I have a dedicated website for my fictions, which is ClaudiaRoseSeries.com. And everybody's invited to my book launch party, so they can email me for the date and time.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Cheerio.
Bye-bye.
That was Sheila Lowe. She has a mystery series, Claudia Rose Mystery Series, and a book called The Complete Idiot's Guide to Handwriting Analysis, which I find terribly interesting, actually. Now I'm like, you know, looking at everybody's handwriting going, aha, I see who you are. Now I know who you are. Anyway, and Jill Amadio, thank you for being in the studio with me.
Thank you, thank you, Sheila, and thank you, Barbara. My other favorite writer.
That's all the time we have for today. If you want to know more about the show or literary events in the area, or Jill's website is jillamadio.com.
Yeah, very simple.
Very simple.
One word. Jill Amadio. Say it quickly.
More events in the area, you can visit my website, penonfire.com. There's a few things coming up. There's a Sisters in Crime meeting on April 27th in Irvine. You can find out more at ocsistersincrime.org. You can go to my site, penonfire.com, to learn about other things going on. And that's it. We're out of here. The fun drive starts on Monday, so I hope you start jiggling your pockets and see what sort of change you can throw at us, because we need help keeping the lights on. Until next time, thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine.